Good evening, everybody. This is Jim Breerling. Welcome to our June 30 session. Our presenter tonight follows in very highfalutin footsteps. Eric Kandel, the eminent New York City psychiatrist and Nobel Prize laureate, didn't rest on his Nobel Prize, but has continued well into his senior years as a very productive scientist, and he has a new book out, The Age of Insight. And a lot of what it relates to the emotional content of faces and reactions in the viewer. So our speaker tonight is following in this focus of Eric Kandel of Nobel Prize fame. And our presenter is Christopher Marcus Crewe, who is nearing completion of his PhD work in Columbia University in the School of Psychology with Geraldine Downey, who some of you will recall from her very engaging and exciting presentation on rejection sensitivity. Christopher got his bachelor's degree at the University of California, Riverside, and he was already showing a very productive bent toward research, and he, while at Riverside, did a high-dimensional memory model to examine the nature of contemporary racial stereotypes in television news media. And he also was the student presenter at the large graduation ceremony for his class. So his acumen and achievements were recognized generally at Riverside. He then went on to the Georgia Institute of Technology in the psychology school there for a master's degree. And one of the interesting things looking at language there, he is a co-author of a paper, I zoom out of his time at Georgia Tech, toward a neurobiological model of cue-induced self-control in decision-making, relevance to addiction and obesity, in the Journal of Neuroscience, a very prestigious journal and a very timely and appropriate topic that might have some traction. Then he came on to Columbia and has been very active there with Geraldine and others. I also want to say that he's done quite a bit of work, coursework in statistics, and has taught research methods as well as helped teaching children at risk and the science of psychology and mind, brain, and behavior. And he was recognized by a presidential award that Columbia University gets to just a few budding teachers, scholars, each year, and he received the Columbia University Presidential Teaching Award for outstanding teaching by a graduate student, and Columbia puts their money where their mouth is. There was an $8,000 check that came with this, but I learned the other day in talking to Chris, there is a catch to it. You got to teach a course. So he is doing that. And he has other very professionally active in grants and affiliations. But I want to get out of the way here and let him on. And also thank all those. A number of people have sent, we have three primary reviewers. And I have forwarded their excellent array of questions on to Chris so he wasn't kind of stunned and surprised. Some of them could be addressed in the course of his talk. Some go beyond his range of expertise, and that's all right, but it opens up a very big opportunity for some exciting discussion. And then some other folks had questions that we were talking about beforehand, and I will get back to those folks separately about those. I want to mention, though, that you'll come up in the early slides several sets of letters that identify instruments. Those are very respected instruments in the field. People remember Leanna Clark's thing of people getting different results with different measures. I don't know what the solution is going to be for that, but these are very sound measures. And also there was a couple people asked about the statistical procedures, kind of what's going on And I told Chris I'd take them off the hook. Essentially, the samples are not going to be identical in a number of ways. And these test methods, statistical methods, allow one to make the groups roughly, pretty precisely actually, equivalent, so you can do an even-handed comparison of outcomes. And maybe sometime we should do a session on statistical methods and some of the issues, but I wanted to save Chris time, and particularly since we have such an array of interesting questions that have been asked. So let me stop and turn it over to the soon-to-be Dr. Crewe.
Thank you, Joe. That was an amazing introduction, actually. I appreciate that. Are you hearing me okay, Jim?
Yes, you're coming through quite clear.
Okay, fantastic. All right, so as Jim said, I'm a graduate student here at Columbia University. I'm scheduled to actually defend my thesis in the fall. And this is work that I've been doing in collaboration with Geraldine Downey, my advisor, Isaac Azor, who's an honor student here at Columbia University, and Kathy Berenson from Gettysburg College, who has been a mentor and collaborator on this project, in addition to Karine Korfman at Kent State and Esko Raffaele at Bar Ilan University in Israel. And so I do want to say, as Jim has pointed out, I am a social and personality psychologist. And so we've done work in the lab with Geraldine Downey where we focused on rejection sensitivity. So I'm coming at this from the perspective of applying basic research on social and personality psychology to applications of its relevance to both borderline and avoidant personality disorder. And so in our lab, or actually before I want to point out that as I move from slide to slide, I will let you know as I move to the next. So we'll start by starting at the first slide. So we're talking about rejection sensitivity, where in our lab we define rejection sensitivity as anxious expectations of rejection. And we study this because of its relationship to both borderline and avoidant personality disorder. So if we look here on page 2, where we see kind of the description of the characteristics associated with both personality disorders, you see they're characterized by frantic efforts to avoid abandonment, which is an borderline personality disorder, unstable relationships, affect and identity, anger, self-injury, and impulsive gratification. And whereas we have avoidant personality disorder, which is associated with efforts to avoid situations where rejection is possible and actually giving up valued activities because their goal of avoiding rejection is strong. And so, but what we focus on for this particular study is where they actually overlap. And this, again, this is the fear of rejection. And as you see, what I've highlighted here in red is that those who are in borderline personality disorder, as far as these frantic efforts to avoid abandonment, may have some implications for not only emotion regulation or emotion processing, but also attentional deployment in the context of threat. And the same may be true of avoidant personality disorder, where the process of actually dealing with and interacting with threat cues is actually just to avoid them. And so we started with the basic questions of thinking about how these disorders are manifest themselves behaviorally and whether or not they have something to say about emotion regulation, processing, and attentional deployment. And so what we've done is across three studies, looked at, one, the detection of emotion, then two, the deployment of attention in the context of dealing with social threat, and then looking more at more ecologically valid version of what actually happens when you're looking at a kind of a threatening video or image and have to make some kind of perceptual process about that. And the motivation for this is that there's been some mixture of findings in the literature about borderline personality disorder, and there's been work by Marcia Linehan, Furtuck up at Columbia University Psychiatric Institute, and the mixed findings is basically pointed to a lower threshold for detecting emotion, particularly anger or even disapproval. So what we wanted to do in study one, use this emotion recognition paradigm to actually see if we can either replicate or fail to replicate some of the findings on borderline personality disorder. And again, we use avoidant personality disorder as a comparison group because of the overlap in rejection sensitivity. And so we move to slide 3. We see what our sample here. So this is a mean age of about 36, and we got the sample from in and around New York City. We recruited from the New York Psychiatric Institute. We recruited from in and around the Columbia campus and greater New York City. And the eligibility criterion that we used was the SCID and the SID-P. And we excluded participants if they met criterion for both borderline and avoidant personality disorder, so comorbidity, if there was any intoxication, or if they had limited literacy. And for the healthy controls, we excluded if they had any Axis 1 disorder in the past 12 months, if they have greater than two symptoms of a single PD, and whether or not they were on medications. And their general function had to be greater than 80. And someone asked a question, which I'll answer that, was what was the actual numbers for the criterion or cutoff for the GAF score for the avoidant and borderline personality disorder? So the range went from 35 to 93, where the average for the avoidance was 53 on the GAF, and the average for BPD was 51 on the GAF. Okay. And so the facial emotion recognition task, if we move on to the next slide, slide number four. Just a second. And so what we did was set up a task where we morphed faces all the way from emotion to neutral. So neutral was the starting point. And so we showed each participant eight trials. It was a mix where we morphed from 10% to 90% of that emotion. And these pairs went from angry to neutral, from happy to neutral, sad to neutral, and then fear to neutral. Now, this was all presented in a randomized and balanced order, and we controlled for gender. And the pictures that we got were the Ekman photos, and what they showed was facial affect. So if we move on to slide number five, what you'll see is what the task looked like. And so they were showed one of these pictures sequentially, one at a time, and it was a different percentage of the morph, and it could be afraid, fear faces, happy, angry, sad, and neutral. And what their task was just to press a button that indicated which emotion they think was displayed in this actual picture. So if we now look at slide number six, you can see actually an example of what the morphs look like. So this is here sad, morphing from 0%, which will be neutral, all the way to 100% of sad. And again, these pictures are appearing one at a time, not in order, there was a random order, and they're just pressing a button to determine what emotion they think is being displayed in this particular picture. Okay. And so what we ran on slide seven, the analysis that we used was this multinomial logistic regression. And as Jim explained, we ran these analyses to help deal with unequal sample sizes and the non-independence of data as well. And so what we're looking for in each emotion is we're measuring the threshold. And so we are defining this as a signal strength where subjects had an equal probability of choosing an underlying emotion and of choosing neutral. So what that means is, on slide 8, you can see we're looking at the threshold or the slope of the tangent line. So if we look at the graph on the left, we have the probability of choosing a particular emotion from 0 all the way to 1. And across the x-axis, what we have is the signal strength going all the way from 10% up to 90%. Now, this is just an example that is for the sad neutral morph. You can see this is a picture where they were actually going from sad to neutral. And at 30% of the morph, there's a slope of the tangent lines are equal. So that's the equal probability of being able to press a button and say you either see sad or neutral. And what we're interested in is at what point does this particular threshold become equal for both and whether or not they are moderated or some way different between groups. Okay. So if we look at page slide number 9, what you see is that basically what we found here on the y-axis, again, this is percent of signal strength, and these are the analysis for each group, for each emotion by group. And we found basically no group differences in the threshold for detecting emotion. So if you look at the first anger, you see there are no statistical differences at that point. And the same thing is true for fear, sadness, and happy. Now, I will say, if we look at the yellow bar for the avoidant personality disorder, and you look across all four of the emotions, there was a marginally significant between anger and fear, suggesting that maybe avoidance may require slightly more signal strength that actually makes the decision on whether or not they see that emotion in that particular picture. But again, as far as the statistical significance, there were overall no group differences. And so I want to pause at this point just to slow down a little bit. And there were a couple of questions that I think are directly related to this particular study, which I would like to try to provide a few answers about. So the first question was, is there a gender effect? And we will say that we did not see any gender differences in this analysis. And the second question was whether or not men or women process facial recognition in different hemispheres. Now, I think this may fall into that category of questions that may be outside of my expertise, but I did do a little digging in the research, in the literature, and generally what the literature has said is that there were no that women tend to be better at processing nonverbal cues than men, and that the amygdala and both the temporal lobes have been associated with emotion processing. But as far as finding differences as far as brain area and development, there doesn't appear to be any research that supports that possibility as far as gender differences are concerned. So there was another question about whether or not facial recognition is something like language. I think as far as the developmental question is concerned, again, by 6 months, as far as the literature that I've read, children have basically developed that skill or the ability to detect emotion in faces. And that's been particularly consistent across the literature. So if I bring this back now to what this means in terms of borderline personality disorder, I think what we're seeing here is now gets us back to really the focus of what we were trying to do in our work. And so if we've come from the position of, if it's not about emotion detection or having a lower threshold for detecting emotion, what we've seen in rejection sensitivity, the model that we primarily use, is that at the point of actually detecting threat, is that that's where you might start seeing some of the affective and cognitive differences that individuals may deploy in the context of dealing with a threat. So what do I mean by that? So if you think about attention and what attention is for, so attention allows us to deal with the environment in a way where we can strategically, whether it's automatic or controlled, process information in the environment. And so the way we've thought about this in terms of rejection sensitivity is that if you have anxious expectations of rejection and the system is biased to actually detect the threat and then do things to thwart the rejection, then that may be the point of time where it's best to study or look for differences, group differences, in terms of how individuals deal with social threat. And so in terms of answering that question in the context of borderline personality disorder, if we move on to slide number 10, we're asking the question whether or not either PD might be associated with distinct patterns of attentional bias. Now, again, we are interested in intentional biases because they may actually help understand maybe the underlying mechanism that helps maintain a lot of the interpersonal difficulties that were associated with rejection sensitivity. So we tried to expand that and apply that to borderline personality disorder as well. So there's been a lot of research that has used what's known as this DOT probe, which is now on slide 11. And what this is a selective attention paradigm. And what it does is it looks at the shifts of attention that are more covert in nature. So in this particular task, what you do is you present the participants with this fixation cross. It stays on the screen for about 500 milliseconds. And then a picture appears on the screen with two pictures of the same actor, as you see here, side by side, displaying different emotions. It can be threat paired with a neutral, happy paired with a neutral, and then we have the control condition that has two neutral pictures side by side. And those pictures stay on the screen for 500 milliseconds. And after the picture disappears, an arrow pops up in the location of one of the pictures. Now, the task of the participant is just to select the direction of the arrow as quickly as possible without making a mistake. And those are the exact instructions given to them. So the great thing about this paradigm is that the participants are never asked to explicitly pay attention to the photos. The task for them is just to select the direction of the arrow as quickly as possible. So to the extent that the attention is drawn to threatening cues, then they should be quicker to select the direction of the arrow when it appears in the location of a threat, if they have this kind of vigilance for threat. Or maybe they'll be slower to detect an arrow in the location of a threat if they're disengaging or avoiding the information. And so that two statements that I just mentioned, if we look on slide 12, has kind of been a discussion in the literature. Well, you have some research has found that, particularly with social phobia, is that individuals with social phobia show this avoidance of threatening cues. I'm sorry, they go towards threatening cues. And so these are populations with, again, social phobia or anxious individuals using the DOT probe. And what that means in the context of the DOT probe is that if you're going towards threat, that you're quicker to detect the direction or press the button that indicates the direction of the arrow when it's in the location of a threat cue. Now, work done in our lab by Kathy Berenson and also Danny Pine at the NIMH using PTSD and DeWitt and the colleagues using anxious and ambivalent attachment, what they found was that actually that predicts avoidance of threat cues. So individuals with PTSD and borderline personality, or at least features of borderline personality disorder done by Kathy Berenson, show that individuals with those features were slower actually to detect the probe when it was in the location of a threat. And so what we want to do now in this study is expand this to the actual clinical sample. And I failed to mention at the beginning that these studies, all three studies that I mentioned, are actually the same sample across, same group of individuals across the studies. And so what we're asking is whether or not borderline and avoidant personality disorder may actually manifest in kind of distinct patterns of attentional deployment. So you remember at the beginning, when we think about borderline personality disorder as these frantic efforts to avoid abandonment, and avoidant personality disorder being this fear of approaching situations that may where rejection is possible, what we think is that they may map on nicely to the both avoidant and vigilant patterns, where the borderline personality disorder may be associated with more avoidant patterns, and then the avoidant personality disorder may be associated with vigilance. So if we look now on slide 13, where we look at the, this is the analytic strategy that we used, was a mixed model multivariate de novo, where we had our within subject factors, was whether or not the probe was in the location of a threat or a happy, and then the between subject factor being the groupings, and we controlled for current mood, in this case was negative mood, and the difference score, or the main dependent measure, is reaction time. Now, we compute reaction time as a difference score. So we subtract from the reaction time to neutrals when the probe was in the location of a neutral from the reaction time to when the probe was in the location of a threatening picture. And so if we look on slide 14. So on the y-axis, we have our bias scores. Again, to the extent that you're positive, that the numbers are positive, that means that they were slower to detect a probe that was in the location of a threat. And I'm sorry, they were, yes, slower to detect the probe in the location of a threat. And to the extent that they are negative numbers, it means that they were faster to do so. All right, and so what we see here is we pick up a group by emotion interaction. And what this suggests, if we look here for threat explicitly, we see that both the healthy controls and the avoidance were showing vigilance for threat. So they were detecting probes in the location of a threat more quickly than those who were borderline. And if you look on happy, there were no group differences across there. So what this suggests is as far as an intentional deployment, again, we didn't see any differences in the emotion detection, but what we see is that these early emergence of any group differences in terms of dealing with social threat, in this case, is emerging as these specific patterns of selectively attending to information. So it may not be necessarily a signal as far as determining whether or not something is a threat. It's once you've actually encountered the threat and now you're you're charged with a task that requires you to actually shift your attention, you've seen biases emerge in terms of borderlines being more focused on threat, I mean the avoidance being more focused on threat and the borderlines going away from threat. And Jim, has any other questions come in? Should I pause for a moment or continue on?
Sorry, I had the mute on. No, nothing significant, but thank you for asking.
Okay. So I think, just a moment. Okay. And I want to actually, so this is a good point. There was a question about how these might be interpreted in terms of differences in neurocircuitry or in terms of learning experiences. Now, I'll take the learning experiences question, part of that question, because I find that to be a fascinating question and one that I've been seriously considering and interested in. And so I've my thesis, actually, it focuses on this very question. The literature has split up the discussion in terms of if you're vigilant for information or you avoid the information, the pattern in and of itself is not necessarily reflective of what the consequences are. Because if you're vigilant for information, you may miss out on cues that actually disambiguate whether or not that was truly a threat source. So you're not able to determine the true nature of the threat source if you're vigilant and you're focusing on kind of internal characteristics of the self, how you feel about this particular rejection occurrence, or if you're avoiding it. If you just, you know, you see the threat and then you get away from it very quickly. So the pattern in and of itself is not of consequence. It's that if you develop one of these strategies and you miss out on opportunities to learn, then how do you actually update your experiences with more positive occurrences? So that's kind of been the focus of my time here at Columbia is answering that particular question. And I will say, this is data that I'm actually writing up now, I developed a learning paradigm with Dr. Jennifer Mangels at Brew College here in New York City. And she's used a particular paradigm that's it's good for EEGs or ERPs, event-related potentials, which kind of measure timing of events in the brain. And what I've done is developed a paradigm that allows me to look at reaction to performance feedback as my kind of model of how individuals respond to negative feedback. And so in this paradigm, we are presenting individuals with an opportunity to answer general knowledge questions, like what is the capital of New York City? And when they answer that particular question, they're allowed to provide a confidence rating, and then we give them negative performance feedback because we titrate them for very, very low performance on this particular task. And what we're measuring is to the extent that your reaction to the negative performance feedback may actually block opportunities to learn. So there's two ERP components related to that we're using as kind of measures of reactivity and attention. And we have FRN, which is known as the feedback-related negativity, and that's kind of registering of worse-than-expected outcomes. And you have the late positive potential, which is kind of sustained attention, motivationally relevant attention to performance feedback. And what I'm asking in that particular study is the extent that you react to negative performance feedback, and you pay attention to that performance feedback, kind of in a rumination kind of way, if you think about it, that if you're reacting and you're paying attention specifically at the performance feedback, if immediately after that I provide you with corrective information about the question that you just got wrong, then that may be the process by which difficulty updating, overriding negative experiences with positives may be missing out on the opportunity in that particular situation. And so that's, you know, preliminary. I am using rejection sensitivity. Haven't quite moved this into the clinical sample, but you know, by studying rejection sensitivity, I will say preliminary evidence suggests that the reason why in a paradigm like that, someone who's high in rejection sensitivity may not learn and update is because the reactivity of the areas in feedback-related negativity and sustained attention are actually zeroing in your attention so focused in that you don't pay attention to corrective information. And so that's something I'm looking to expand later, but that's kind of a long-winded response to that particular question where I think learning is a fascinating question, and I'm going to continue doing work that actually shows that these type of reactions to rejection, particularly your attentional biases to social threat, can be actually be measured in a way that shows that learning and updating of past negative experiences is probably being missed. Okay. So if we move on to just the last study that's being presented here, we move on to slide number 15, and we're asking whether or not either PD is associated with the tendency to read reject intent into others' expressions. So again, getting back to our original, my starting point was that in the literature there's been some kind of discrepancy. There's been mixed findings on whether or not, you know, the emotion recognition, there's a lower threshold for doing so. Our data suggests that, at least here, we don't see any differences in the detection part of it. What we do see differences start to arise is in the actual active deployment of attention in the presence of dealing or seeing or encountering a social threat cue. Oh, and before I jump into study three, I actually forgot to mention that we've actually done this study, the dot probe study, and expanded it into an eye tracking study as well. Now, we were interested in the eye tracking portion of it because reaction time, although a great measure in the dot probe, it actually doesn't allow you to see in real time exactly how attention is being deployed. Now, we do have some evidence as we're collecting data suggesting that the avoidance that we see in borderlines is actually better explained by shifts of attention in far as dealing with the threat. So what we see is when those who are borderline personality disorder, they have more of a tendency to go towards threat, so as far as the initial shifts of attention. And then the eye movements do show shorter gaze durations on threat. So it's kind of a nice complement to what we see in the reaction time data in terms of understanding these patterns of attention deployment. Okay. So proceeding on to study three. So what we've done, we've adapted, this is slide number 16. And what we've done is we've adapted a paradigm developed by Rainer Romero Cañas, a graduate of Columbia University and also a postdoc in our lab, who left us 2 years ago. But what he did was develop a set of videos where he had individuals being recorded as they naturally express liking or disliking for someone. And so what the viewers, the actors in the video were told to do was imagine initial meeting with, I'm sorry, the videos themselves were recordings of individuals who were told to think about someone that they liked or disliked, and he recorded them as they kind of ginned up memories about people that they liked and disliked. So that's the set of videos that were then used in this study. And so what the participants in this study were asked to do was imagine an initial meeting with a neighbor, and they were told to make attributions about the person and how they felt that that person would treat them and how they in turn would react to that person. So if we look on slide 17, this is an actual positive rating video where this particular actor here was actually thinking about someone that they liked. And so they were then showing kind of positive reactions. And so what we these videos were indeed normed by independent raters for their both positivity and negativity. So if we look at slide number 18, what you see is this is a video where this particular actor here was actually thinking about a person that they did not like. And again, these were normed for negativity. And so what we did was we had a set of questions that we had participants answer. And the first question was, is the target being deliberately hurtful? We asked them, is the target being inconsiderate? How likely would the target be to accept you as a friend? And how likely would you be to avoid the target? Now, what the idea being is that these videos have indeed been normed for the actual positivity and negativity content, and we want to see whether or not the affect being displayed in the picture mapped onto the perceptions that were given by the participants, and whether or not there were any group differences in terms of perceptions or assessments of this particular individual in the video. All right, so on slide 20, what you see is our analytical approach. Again, this was a univariate ANOVA, or between subject factor was group, and we also control for current mood. And again, we were asking for ratings of perceived hurt or intent, how much inconsiderateness they saw in that particular individual, whether or not they expected to be accepted by this individual, and their intent to actually avoid the target that was in the video. Okay, so if we look at slide number 21, these are videos that are actually showing the negative videos. That would be the female actor that you saw earlier. And again, we're asking him on a Likert scale of scale 1 to 9, how much hurtful intent do you see in this person or in this particular video? And we do see group differences. Interaction was driven by the fact that the BPD saw more negative or hurtful intent in the videos relative to the healthy controls. Now, they didn't differ from the avoidance in this particular analysis. And so what we're seeing is early emergence of seeing more hurtful intent, particularly in negative videos. But we were interested in what would happen when the video was actually positive. And so that's what we see here on slide 22. Now, these are actually positive videos. This is the individual, the male actor at the beginning. He's asked them to think about a situation and the person that he liked, and then he was recorded doing that. So what we're interested in, whether or not it would be more positive or negative associations assigned to that particular individual. So if we think about the question about inconsiderate, this is slide 22. The first question was, how inconsiderate do you see this person to be? And there was a significant interaction showing that borderlines had a higher rating of feeling that this person was more inconsiderate, more so than both the healthy controls and the avoidant personality disorder. And we see the same thing for acceptance, and we see the same thing for avoidance. I'm sorry, got that backwards. So as far as acceptance is concerned, the healthy controls thought they were more likely to receive acceptance, more so than both borderlines and avoidance. Now, if we look at the avoid question, we see that borderlines were reporting a greater likelihood of are saying that they were more likely to avoid this particular person in comparison both to the healthy controls and the avoidance. And so it looks like in this situation, we have a positive video that there were more negative attributions being assigned to the person in the video, even though, again, it's been normed and rated for positivity. And I just wanted to show you a few quotes on page 23. And I just want to be careful as I present this, because this is more just for illustrative purposes so we can really get a good feel for what it is that we picked up on in this study. And so I'd be interested to hear, you know, any feedback or insight. But what we were doing is pulled out a few quotes of the feelings that were associated with actually viewing a positive video. And so you can see a few. I felt the person was either sarcastic or maybe flirty. He thinks that I'm an idiot and so is mocking me. I don't want to go through the entire list, but we just thought this was kind of interesting. I mean, if we think back to where we are in terms of the data in the studies 2 and 3, well, you have this attentional bias where you avoid information if you're borderline, or you go towards it if you're avoidant, that maybe that has something, some implications for actually how you interact with even positive information. So remember I said earlier that my idea of what might be going on is that if your self-regulatory strategy for dealing with potential threats is to avoid that information, then maybe you miss out on opportunities to actually learn and disambiguate that context and say, oh, actually, this was a positive interaction, or this person wasn't, you know, mocking me. So I think it's kind of interesting in that regard, because we think about what's been done with Marshall Linehan, with dialectical behavior therapy, reappraisal training at the research level that's being done with Kevin Ochsner and even Jim Gross's emotion regulation models, mindfulness training. Now, all those things kind of come into play here in terms of how we should probably be thinking about this. And I'll just say a few words about that if we move on to the slide 24. I'm thinking about this in terms of, again, how do you retrain this process? And I mentioned earlier, I think in the conversation with Jim before we started, is that there are a lot of work, recent studies coming out that are looking at ways to actually retrain attentional deployment. So if you can retrain individuals to kind of, in the context of DBT, to be in the moment without reacting, then that might be a positive kind of step in the direction of reducing these attentional biases and allowing an individual to harness their attention in a way that they can actually use it to engage with the threat source. So that's to, you know, to kind of reduce the avoidance or reduce the persistent vigilance and thoughts or rumination that may come with a particularly possible rejection experience. So again, our model has always come from, you know, the rejection sensitivity model about anxious expectations of rejection and actually how to reduce those kind of those biases or attentional biases that come with it. So if we think about if-then contingencies is the way we think about it. If this happens, I'm going to do this. Right? So we've seen work in the basic science by Ethan Cross, who's a student, former student of Walter Mischel here at Columbia University, was kind of used these kind of models of thinking about emotion regulation, affect, and thought suppression, or even distancing. If you can somehow distance yourself from it and be in that moment, or kind of actively control the attention, then that may be a way to actually tap into reducing some of the perceptions or misperceptions of behaviors that may come about. We see the similar threshold across groups, even for the healthy controls. We see this vigilant avoidant pattern that's associated with borderline personality disorder, and we see the more persistent vigilant pattern and avoiding personality disorder. And when you're asked to actually perceive or imagine someone in a video clip, you see this kind of greater tendency or likelihood of assigning negative intentions, even in the context of positive videos. So again, in the context of everything we do in our lab from the basic science and research component, there seems to be a few things that can be done in terms of attentional retraining, distancing, emotion regulation. Anything within that realm seems like it may be something that's a step in the right direction in the terms of understanding and maybe even developing treatments around that. And that's all I want to say about that because, again, as Jim pointed out at the beginning, I'm not actually a clinician, so I'll be careful on how much I say we can actually apply this now in this day and moment. But I think there is a lot of positive kind of information out there that points in the right direction. And that brings me back to our final slide. It seems like I've finished a little bit early, so maybe I can field a few more questions. But I want to thank the NIMH for the funding the project, one of the studies that was done with the attention deployment. And I want to thank Jim for all of his help. He's been extremely, extremely helpful, having general conversations, talking about my research and where he's been in his career and where I could go moving forward. That's been extremely helpful, and I thank him for that. And to the research participants, some of them I will actually tell you a situation that truly touched me in the process of running some of these studies. We were running a participant that had come all the way from Jersey. Now, our study doesn't pay that much, and I found out she had come from Jersey. And I said, wow, I mean, it cost you more to get here from Jersey than where I should be paying. And what she said to me was that if the work you're doing in your lab and somehow helps me and others, I would come for free. And so that was something that really just, that was a statement that really put it in the context of what I'm doing. Because, again, I'm not a clinician. I am interested in clinical psychology and the training here. I hope to, as I move into a postdoc, to be able to get more of the clinical training, but I it just really made me get, really excited about being able to do work that may be directly applicable and actually may do something that is of good for understanding mental health and in treating it. So again, I thank you for this opportunity. It's been fascinating. It's extremely exciting, and I want to make sure that I give this special thank before I go to my advisor Geraldine Downey, who for even allowing me to this opportunity and mentoring me and training me. And I thank you guys for sitting with me. And if you have any questions, I guess now is the time.
Chris, thank you for a very clear, well-organized presentation. No wonder you got the Presidential Teaching Award. I'd like to pick up on a couple of things that I gathered people would be very interested in. That is, actually reading their questions and looking at that the other evening in the grocery line, there was an older couple ahead of me. I mean, of course, I'm much younger in my illusions. And as one of the reviewers commented, as you get older, you get wrinkles and so forth, and that could look unattractive or forbidding. But she then... it so happened conversation emerged about the National Geographic, and she had such a delightful, pleasant, soft smile and a pleasant, warm voice that whatever the facial features were just became irrelevant. We're more than overwhelmed. So it kind of, are people doing research on the voice and expression and the mannerisms sometimes? Do people step back, or do they look down and away, or do they make eye contact and have a nice smile? That would convey a lot of information, I would think.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I know bits and pieces about this because I was, as you mentioned, when I was in Georgia Tech, some of our work was in language studying and language processing and production. And I will say this, as far as what I do know, actual work. In our lab, she's now a graduate. She's currently at Stanford University. She's now a postdoc at Stanford University. Her name is Lauren Aguilar. And she was actually studying mimicry as a function of rejection sensitivity and how that went about helping in relationship development and formation. And what she was looking at was nonverbal communication parts. And generally, I don't want to butcher her study, but what Lauren was showing was that if you're high in rejection sensitivity and you're actually mimicking someone who is also low in rejection sensitivity, the normal affiliation that's created through mimicry actually disappears. So if you're mimicking, those who are high in rejection sensitivity tend to mimic others' behaviors in order as an effort to gain acceptance. But it actually results in the opposite kind of expected result, because if you're mimicking others' behaviors, but you give off nonverbals as far as ingratiation, things that may be perceived as, you know, not necessarily a way to establish relationship, and actually backfires on you. So people are in tune, and these aren't explicit instructions given to participants. They're just generally interacting as a dyadic partner, and these nonverbal cues that are given off by those who are high rejection sensitivity can actually affect their ability to establish those relationships. Now, in terms of the visual processing, we do know that the eyes, if you look at just basic visual scan patterns, people tend to gather more information from the eyes and the mouth. So if you give kind of this, say, open-ended visual, you know, task where they can scan the picture, you see more attention given to the eyes and the mouth, which brings me to someone else's question about autism. So I did look that up. It does turn out that individuals with autism actually don't have the normal scan path in terms of paying attention to the eyes and to the mouth. So there may be some suggestion on, you know, as far as understanding interpersonal interactions, that deviation from the normal patterns of looking at areas on the face where you can gather the most information from may actually be kind of a correlation or a link to why emotional processing or interpersonal interactions may be somewhat less in an individual with autism.
The other part that I think there's high interest in, and it's going to be a challenge, borderlines are very expensive and difficult, and until recently it's been very difficult to get insurance coverage, so the care that they could get was often misdiagnosed, was limited partly for financial reasons, but also because therapists sought to actively avoid them, and relations with parents were strained. But one of the big part of the our sponsoring organization, the NEA-BPD activity, is a family connection course that provides up-to-date research information and some skills, primarily drawn from Marshall Linehan's DBT, that they can use in interacting, well, actually everywhere, but particularly with their borderline child. And the kind of difficulty that you're mentioning, so often the borderline is perceiving rejection. I can think of some interactions I had, one who felt that I was really spurning her and hostile and so forth, and it was at a convention and not having any hearing in the left ear, and she was far on my left side. There was no way I could hear her over the crowd calling out my name. And other times it was clear that, you know, if people didn't respond with a warm smile and greeting, it was like, hey, that's rejecting. Well, you know, the person can be preoccupied and just kind of unaware with you. And it was like, oh yeah, my boyfriend tells me that. But the challenge for a parent, how can you help a child that sees all this negativism coming up? And as you point out, you tend to we tend to think with somebody, so if we're putting out bad vibes, they're putting out bad vibes, or vice versa. And yet it's so painful for the parent, and they so much want to help.
Yeah, that is a very large question, which I unfortunately may be actually unqualified to answer, but I'll answer that with a response that there's a few books out there on borderline personality disorder, and what I'm currently reading, the author's name is slipping me, but it's called I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, which I think it's a really good way to kind of put things in perspective, and there was one more book also that I'm missing, but it told the story of an individual, actually her story, as she went through the diagnosis and went through ups and downs through the treatment, and actually, you know, ended up successfully, you know, being treated for it, and If anyone knows that name, I would. If you know the book that I'm speaking of, I'm sorry that it's slipping me now. But I was kind of struck by just how you say you're right, it's labor-intensive to actually deal with the treatment. But one thing the clinician in the book that she spoke of actually did a very, very good job of was patience. I mean, it was actually, it's more complex than that, but the clinician, I was struck by his approach, by being able to regulate himself, you know, regulate himself to where the expectation of, you know, I'm upset or you explode emotionally, and because it is the expectation of rejection that they're looking for. So creating an environment where doing things that actually go through the cycle of my expectation of rejection is high, I do things to trigger rejection, I see it, and then kind of the cycle goes. But the best thing that the clinician did in that book was he himself having that emotion regulation. I know it can be difficult on the person on the other side of that interaction, but in my assessment, again, my layperson assessment of that, it just seems like it's a long process. It's something that's a long haul. I think if people understand when someone has this diagnosis, just how much they need you, the parent, the family members, to be patient with them as they move through this and get better. That could be my only piece of advice that I would offer, and I'm reluctant to go beyond that.
If you had the money support, what would be the next study you'd do?
Well, it would be actually, so I because of the promising data that's coming out of the EEG study that I'm doing now, I want to expand that to something a little bit larger, because right now what I have is a single kind of setup where the feedback is, you know, negative emotion feedback. But I would love to expand that to where I can do a full model. The model that I'm interested in testing is actually looking at reactivity, attention, and then level of semantic processing of the feedback. So the wonderful thing about the paradigm that I mentioned earlier is that you can actually map out both semantic and perceptual level processing in the brain. So you can look at both ventral and dorsal level processing. And as a language person, I've always been curious, or as my, in the future, past life, where I was studying language and language production, you know, as far as semantic and perceptual level perceptual processing, what I mean is if you see a word presented like cat, you can look at the features of the word cat. Or you can do a semantic level. You can think about a cat, fluffy, you know, wonderful pets. You know, you can get deeper in that thought. And so I do want to answer this question on if you're reacting, if you pay a lot of attention to negative information, at what point and how is your learning affected? You know, this is why I'm thinking in terms of a treatment, is why, you know, treatments or therapies may take a little bit longer if the reactivity component of it overrides learning opportunities. And so to expand that to a more detail, to look at not only across disorders but across different emotions, angry, threatening, disapproval, to get a full understanding not only from perceptual level processing but even memory for the person who triggered the rejection. So it's kind of in line with maybe even a PTSD link, because we do have some data linking borderline personality disorder with PTSD. And also to learn more about the avoiding personality sample. I mean, there's a lot of literature dedicated to understanding borderline personality disorder, but I would love to also start developing ways to study more and get more detailed information about the avoiding personality disorder sample as well.
Yeah, and there's a question popped up about peer influence, and it ties back to high schools, is that students would say, if the issue came up about using drugs, everybody is doing it, or smoking, everybody's doing it, that's less so now, or having sex, everybody's doing it. And the people conducted anonymous surveys, and the findings, the self-reports, were exactly to the contrary. And providing that feedback helped to form a new, if you will, cultural norm for behavior, that no, everybody wasn't having sex, no, everybody wasn't using drugs, and so forth. In fact, a substantial majority were not. So the question is, is there a role for peers in a kind of a group exercise to provide feedback and contrast to kind of, hey, you know, just implicitly your norm may be off from the rest of the group? without being didactic about it. It's just...
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Actually, I really like that question. That's one I would have to think on a little bit more. I'll put it this way. I'll answer this question indirectly. So Tory Higgins in our department, he studies motivation. And in his work, he approaches this on value from fit. And basically what he's showing that if you want to change individuals' behaviors or you want to increase performance on the test, it's very important to understand that person's motivational state. And so he talks about promotion and prevention, where promotion is you're seeking or you're motivated to gain rewards, and prevention, you're motivated to stop losses. And this is kind of tangentially related, but his kind of main contribution is that understanding the motivational state of the individual and in crafting statements that fit that motivational state is actually the best way to get through to people. For an example, there's been a lot of work coming out of Columbia as well looking at the Center for Research on Decision Making, for environmental decision making, has been trying to develop ways to get people to be more conscientious about pollution and conserving for the environment. But if you take motivational states, say conservative and liberal, and you may have seen this, if you give them a study and you say for conservatives, you know, we're going to assign, you know, you can donate money to a fund for, you know, reducing emissions in the car. That works. Now, if you use the word tax, it doesn't work. And vice versa. You know, if you're dealing with someone who's liberal and you say, oh, you know, there's going to be a carbon tax, there's no problem with that. And I think his work, and Tory has worked with this group, and he's trying to expand that as well, is that just knowing the motivational state of that student, of that child or that peer group is actually a good way to tap into how do I frame my comments about drugs, about sex, about, you know, drinking, whatever the case may be, that if you can craft that within the context of their motivational standpoint and their understanding, then that's the best way to actually modify behavior.
Can you give an example? Let's say with the high sexual behavior many borderlines engage in, particularly early in their disorders, kind of indiscriminate sex, plunging from one relation and idealizing it and going on, and you'd like to say, hey, there's a high risk of STDs, and HIV/AIDS is maybe at the top of it, but let me tell you, herpes is a drag for this lifetime kind of thing to cope with. So a parent could be very, very distressed, but how do you tap it? What's the motivational state to tap into?
So if you frame that, I mean, the framing is actually quite simple. If it's a maybe someone on the line can actually contact Tory or maybe even themselves try to work to extend this into some type of, I think he may be thinking in this way in terms of an intervention. If someone is motivated not to get a STD, then you frame it in that way. You know, things that you can do to avoid getting an STD. Now, if you are motivated in a promotion sense, as gaining acceptance from peers or through that, you know, activity, then you have to figure out ways to make that activity, let me see, how would I frame that? Your promotion, that is going to drive me crazy, Jim. So that is a question. Actually, I will go to Tory tomorrow. I will raise this question. And can I email that to you and send this to
you? Absolutely, absolutely.
Because I don't want to mess up his model all the way, but I think that's a fascinating question that I'm pretty sure he's interested in. I'm someone who's a parent himself. So I will direct the action to that question.
Good leads for people and so forth to enlarge the dialogue. And it is time to bring things to a conclusion, and thank you very profusely for an excellent evening. Very informative and stimulating. And to tell folks that we will be off next week, next Sunday, and for the 4th of July, but we will be back on July 14th with Bill Fleeson at Wake Forest University. He's a personality psychologist who is interested in a number of things, including happiness, what makes people really happy, but also in the personality situation dilemma. How is it that we can have personality traits that are presumably rather fixed and constant and yet have such fluctuations in their expression over settings, the setting by construct interaction? And his grant allows him to follow a very, very large number of borderlines for quite some time, getting ecological reports from their daily functioning and interactions, and various settings and other people and groups. And this will be his first presentation in year two of the grant. So this could be a very, very exciting and stimulating session. And then on August 4th, we will have Patrick Kennedy, the former congressman who's really gotten engaged with advocating for mental health, and he will be speaking on mental health parity. So just hope that you all will put those on your calendar, that you'll be with us to listen in and comment and send your questions and remarks and feedback. And everybody, have a good evening and have a great week and a 4th of July. Bye, all.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Jim.